1834-35. The misery hardly finds a parallel in the history of commerce. The bones of the cotton weavers are bleaching the plains of India. No doubt, in turning them out of this temporal world, the machinery caused them no more than a temporary inconvenience. For the rest, since machinery is continually seizing upon new fields of production, its temporary effect is really permanent. Hence, the character of independence and estrangement, which the capitalist mode of production as a whole gives to the instruments of labour and to the product as against the workman, is developed by means of machinery into a thorough antagonism. Footnote. The same cause which may increase the revenue of the country, that is, as Ricardo explains in the same passage, the revenues of landlords and capitalists, whose wealth, from the economic point of view, forms the wealth of the nation, may at the same time render the population redundant and deteriorate the condition of the labourer. The constant aim and the tendency of every improvement in machinery is, in fact, to do away entirely with the labour of man, or to lessen its price by substituting the labour of women and children for that of grown-up men, or of unskilled for that of skilled workmen. Your end of footnote. Therefore, it is with the advent of machinery that the workman for the first time brutally revolts against the instruments of labour. The instrument of labour strikes down the labourer. This direct antagonism between the two comes out most strongly whenever newly introduced machinery competes with handicrafts or manufactures, handed down from former times. But even in modern industry, the continual improvement of machinery and the development of the automatic system has an analogous effect. The object of improved machinery is to diminish manual labour, to provide for the performance of a process or the completion of a link in a manufacture by the aid of an iron instead of the human apparatus. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October 1858. The adaptation of power to machinery heretofore moved by hand is almost of daily occurrence. The minor improvements in machinery having for their object economy of power, the production of better work, the turning off more work in the same time, or in supplying the place of a child, a female, or a man, are constant, and although sometimes apparently of no great moment, have somewhat important results. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories for 31st of October 1856. End of footnote. Whenever a process requires peculiar dexterity and steadiness of hand, it is withdrawn as soon as possible from the cunning workman, who is prone to irregularities of many kinds, and it is placed in charge of a peculiar mechanism so self-regulating that a child can superintend it. Footnote. Ure. The great advantage of the machinery employed in brickmaking consists in this, that the employer is made entirely independent of skilled labourers. Children's Employment Commission, 1866. Mr. A. Sturrock, superintendent of the machine department of the Great Northern Railway, says, with regard to the building of locomotives, etc., expensive English workmen are being less used every day. The production of the workshops in England is being increased by the use of improved tools, and these tools are again served by a low class of labour. Formerly, their skilled labour necessarily produced all the parts of the engines. Now the parts of engines are produced by labour with less skill, but with good tools. By tools, I mean engineers' machinery, lathes, planing machines, drills, and so on. Royal Commission on Railways, 1867. End of footnote. Ure says, on the automatic plan, skilled labour gets progressively superseded. The effect of improvements in machinery not merely in superseding the necessity for the employment of the same quantity of adult labour as before in order to produce a given result, but in substituting one description of human labour for another, the less skilled for the more skilled, juvenile for adult, female for male, causes a fresh disturbance in the rate of wages. The effect of substituting the self-acting mule for the common mule is to discharge the greater part of the men spinners, and to retain adolescents and children. The extraordinary power of expansion of the factory system, owing to accumulated practical experience, to the mechanical means at hand, and to constant technical progress, was proved to us by the giant strides of that system under the pressure of a shortened working day. But who, in 1860, the zenith year of the English cotton industry, would have dreamt of the galloping improvements in machinery and the corresponding displacement of working people called into being during the following 3 years under the stimulus of the American Civil War? A couple of examples from the reports of inspectors of factories will suffice on this point. A Manchester manufacturer states, "We formerly had 75 carding engines, now we have 12, doing the same quantity of work. We are doing with fewer hands by 14, at a saving in wages of £10 a week. Our estimated saving in waste is about 10% in the quantity of cotton consumed." In another fine-spinning mill in Manchester, I was informed that through increased speed and the adoption of some self-acting processes, a reduction had been made in number of a fourth in one department and of above half in another, and that the introduction of the combing machine in place of the second carding had considerably reduced the number of hands formerly employed in the carding room. Another spinning mill is estimated to effect a saving of labour of 10%. The Messrs. Gilmore, spinners at Manchester, state, "In our blowing room department, we consider our expense with new machinery is fully one-third less in wages and hands. In the jack frame and drawing frame room, about one-third less in expense, and likewise one-third less in hands. In the spinning room, about one-third less in expenses. But this is not all. When our yarn goes to the manufacturers, it is so much better by the application of our new machinery that they will produce a greater quantity of cloth and cheaper than from the yarn produced by old machinery." Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1863. End of footnote. Mr. Redgrave further remarks in the same report, "The reduction of hands against increased production is, in fact, constantly taking place. In woolen mills, the reduction commenced some time since, and is continuing. A few days since, the master of a school in the neighbourhood of Rochdale said to me that the great falling off in the girls' school is not only caused by the distress, but by the changes of machinery in the woolen mills, in consequence of which a reduction of 70 short-timers had taken place." Footnote. The rapid improvement of machinery during the crisis allowed the English manufacturers, immediately after the termination of the American Civil War, and almost in no time, to glut the markets of the world again. Cloth, during the last 6 months of 1866, was almost unsaleable. Thereupon began the consignment of goods to India and China, thus naturally making the glut more intense. At the beginning of 1867, the manufacturers resorted to their usual way out of the difficulty, viz., reducing wages 5%. The workpeople resisted and said that the only remedy was to work short time, 4 days a week, and their theory was the correct one. After holding out for some time, the self-elected captains of industry had to make up their minds to short time, with reduced wages in some places, and in others without. End of footnote. As a result of the mechanical improvements in the English cotton industry due to the American Civil War, between 1861 and 1868, 338 cotton factories disappeared. In other words, more productive machinery on a larger scale was concentrated in the hands of a smaller number of capitalists. The number of power looms decreased by 20,663, but since their product increased in the same period, an improved loom must have yielded more than an old one. Lastly, the number of spindles increased by 1,612,541, while the number of operatives decreased by 50,505. The temporary misery inflicted on the workpeople by the cotton crisis was heightened, and from being temporary, made permanent by the rapid and persistent progress of machinery. But machinery not only acts as a competitor who gets the better of the workman and is constantly on the point of making him superfluous. It is also a power inimical to him. And as such, capital proclaims it from the rooftops and as such makes use of it. It is the most powerful weapon for repressing strikes, those periodical revolts of the working class against the autocracy of capital. Footnote. The relation of master and man in the blown flint bottle trades amounts to a chronic strike. Hence the impetus given to the manufacture of pressed glass, in which the chief operations are done by machinery. One firm in Newcastle, who formerly produced £350,000 of blown flint glass, now produces in its place £3,500,000 of pressed glass. Children's Employment Commission, 1865. End of footnote. According to Gaskell, the steam engine was from the very first an antagonist of human power, an antagonist that enabled the capitalist to tread underfoot the growing claims of the workmen who threatened the newly born factory system with a crisis. Footnote. Gaskell, The Manufacturing Population of England. London, 1833. End of footnote. It would be possible to write quite a history of the inventions made since 1830 for the sole purpose of supplying capital with weapons against the revolts of the working class. At the head of these in importance stands a self-acting mule, because it opened up a new epoch in the automatic system. Footnote. W. Fairbairn discovered several very important applications of machinery to the construction of machines, in consequence of strikes in his own workshops. End of footnote. Naismith, the inventor of the steam hammer, gives the following evidence before the Trades Union Commission with regard to the improvements made by him in machinery and introduced in consequence of the widespread and long strikes of the engineers in 1851. The characteristic feature of our modern mechanical improvements is the introduction of self-acting tool machinery. What every mechanical workman has now to do, and what every boy can do, is not to work himself, but to superintend the beautiful labour of the machine. The whole class of workmen that depend exclusively on their skill is now done away with. Formerly, I employed 4 boys to every mechanic. Thanks to these new mechanical combinations, I have reduced the number of grown-up men from 1,500 to 750. The result was a considerable increase in my profits. Ewer says of a machine used in calico printing, "At length capitalists sought deliverance from this intolerable bondage, namely the, in their eyes, burdensome terms of their contracts with the workmen, in the resources of science, and were speedily reinstated in their legitimate rule, that of the head, over the inferior members." Speaking of an invention for dressing warps, "Then the combined malcontents, who fancied themselves impregnably entrenched behind the old lines of division of labour, found their flanks turned and their defences rendered useless by the new mechanical tactics, and were obliged to surrender at discretion." With regard to the invention of the self-acting mule, he says, "A creation destined to restore order among the industrious classes, this invention confirms the great doctrine already propounded that when capital enlists science into her service, the refractory hand of labour will always be taught docility. Although Ewer's work appeared 30 years ago, at a time when the factory system was comparatively but little developed, it still perfectly expresses the spirit of the factory, not only by its undisguised cynicism, but also by the naivety with which it blurts out the stupid contradictions of the capitalist brain. For instance, after propounding the doctrine just stated that capital, with the aid of science taken into its pay, always reduces the refractory hand of labour to docility, he grows indignant because it, physico-mechanical science, has been accused of lending itself to the rich capitalist as an instrument for harassing the poor. After preaching a long sermon to show how advantageous the rapid development of machinery is to the working classes, he warns them that by their obstinacy and their strikes, they hasten that development. "Violent revulsions of this nature," he says, "display short-sighted man in the contemptible character of a self-tormentor." A few pages before, he states the contrary. "Had it not been for the violent collisions and interruptions resulting from erroneous views among the factory operatives, the factory system would have been developed still more rapidly and beneficially for all concerned." Then he exclaims again, "Fortunately for the state of society in the cotton districts of Great Britain, the improvements in machinery are gradual." It, improvement in machinery, is said to lower the rate of earnings of adults by displacing a portion of them, and thus rendering their number superabundant as compared with the demand for their labour. It certainly augments the demand for the labour of children, and increases the rate of their wages. On the other hand, this same dispenser of consolation defends the lowness of the children's wages on the ground that it prevents parents from sending their children at too early an age into the factory. The whole of his book is a vindication of a working day of unrestricted length. That Parliament should forbid children of 13 years to be exhausted by working 12 hours a day reminds his liberal soul of the darkest days of the Middle Ages. This does not prevent him from calling upon the factory operatives to thank Providence, who, by means of machinery, has given them the leisure to think of their immortal interests. Section 6. The Theory of Compensation, as regards the workpeople displaced by machinery. James Mill, McCulloch, Torrens, Senior, John Stuart Mill, and a whole series besides of bourgeois political economists insist that all machinery that displaces workmen simultaneously and necessarily sets free an amount of capital adequate to employ the same identical workmen. Footnote. Ricardo originally was also of this opinion, but afterwards expressly disclaimed it with the scientific impartiality and love of truth characteristic of him. See On Machinery. End of footnote. Suppose a capitalist to employ 100 workmen at £30 a year each in a carpet factory. The variable capital annually laid out amounts, therefore, to £3,000. Suppose also that he discharges 50 of his workmen and employs the remaining 50 with machinery that costs him £1,500. To simplify matters, we take no account of buildings, coal, etc. Further suppose that the raw material annually consumed costs £3,000, both before and after the change. Footnote. Nota bene. My illustration is entirely on the lines of those given by the aforementioned economists. End of footnote. Is any capital set free by this metamorphosis? Before the change, the total sum of £6,000 consisted half of constant and half of variable capital. After the change, it consists of £4,500 constant, £3,000 raw material and £1,500 machinery, and £1,500 variable capital. The variable capital, instead of being one-half, is only one-quarter of the total capital. Instead of being set free, a part of the capital is here locked up in such a way as to cease to be exchanged against labour power. Variable has been changed into constant capital. Other things remaining unchanged, the capital of £6,000 can in future employ no more than 50 men. With each improvement in the machinery, it will employ fewer. If the newly introduced machinery had cost less than did the labour power and implements displaced by it, if, for instance, instead of costing £1,500, it had cost only £1,000, a variable capital of £1,000 would have been converted into constant capital and locked up, and a capital of £500 would have been set free. The latter sum, supposing wages unchanged, would form a fund sufficient to employ about 16 out of the 50 men discharged. Nay, less than 16, for in order to be employed as capital, a part of this £500 must now become constant capital, thus leaving only the remainder to be laid out in labour power. But suppose, besides, that the making of the new machinery affords employment to a greater number of mechanics. Can that be called compensation to the carpet makers thrown onto the streets? At the best, its construction employs fewer men than its employment displaces. The sum of £1,500 that formerly represented the wages of the discharged carpet makers now represents, in the shape of machinery, one, the value of the means of production used in the construction of that machinery, two, the wages of the mechanics employed in its construction, and three, the surplus value falling to the share of their master. Further, the machinery need not be renewed till it is worn out. Hence, in order to keep the increased number of mechanics in constant employment, one carpet manufacturer after another must displace workmen by machines. As a matter of fact, the apologists do not mean this sort of setting free. They have in their minds the means of subsistence of the liberated workpeople. It cannot be denied in the above instance that the machinery not only liberates 50 men, thus placing them at others' disposal, but at the same time it withdraws from their consumption and sets free means of subsistence to the value of £1,500. The simple fact, by no means a new one, that machinery cuts off the workmen from their means of subsistence is, therefore, in economic parlance, tantamount to this, that machinery liberates means of subsistence for the workman, or converts those means into capital for his employment. The mode of expression, you see, is everything. Nominibus morire licet mala. This theory implies that the £1,500 worth of means of subsistence was capital that was being expanded by the labour of the 50 men discharged, that consequently this capital falls out of employment so soon as they commence their forced holidays, and never rests till it has found a fresh investment, where it can again be productively consumed by these same 50 men. That sooner or later, therefore, the capital and the workmen must come together again, and that then the compensation is complete. That the sufferings of the workmen displaced by machinery are therefore as transient as are the riches of this world. In relation to the discharged workmen, the £1,500 worth of means of subsistence never was capital. What really confronted them as capital was the sum of £1,500 afterwards laid out in machinery. On looking closer, it will be seen that this sum represented part of the carpets produced in a year by the 50 discharged men, which part they received as wages from their employer in money instead of in kind. With the carpets in the form of money, they bought means of subsistence to the value of £1,500. These means, therefore, were to them not capital, but commodities, and they, as regards these commodities, were not wage labourers, but buyers. The circumstance that they were freed by the machinery from the means of purchase changed them from buyers into non-buyers. Hence a lessened demand for those commodities. Voilà tout. If this diminution be not compensated by an increase from some other quarter, the market price of the commodities falls. If this state of things lasts for some time and extends, there follows a discharge of workmen employed in the production of these commodities. Some of the capital that was previously devoted to production of necessary means of subsistence has to become reproduced in another form. While prices fall and capital is being displaced, the labourers employed in the production of necessary means of subsistence are in their turn freed from a part of their wages. Instead, therefore, of proving that when machinery frees the workman from his means of subsistence, it simultaneously converts those means into capital for his further employment, our apologists, with their cut-and-dried law of supply and demand, prove, on the contrary, that machinery throws workmen on the streets, not only in that branch of production in which it is introduced, but also in those branches in which it is not introduced. The real facts, which are travestied by the optimism of economists, are as follows. The labourers, when driven out of the workshop by the machinery, are thrown upon the labour market, and there add to the number of workmen at the disposal of the capitalists. In Part 7 of this book, it will be seen that the effect of machinery, which, as we have seen, is represented to be a compensation to the working class, is, on the contrary, a most frightful scourge. For the present, I will only say this. The labourers that are thrown out of work in any branch of industry can no doubt seek for employment in some other branch. If they find it, and thus renew the bond between them and the means of subsistence, this takes place only by the intermediary of a new and additional capital that is seeking an investment, not at all by the intermediary of the capital that formerly employed them and was afterwards converted into machinery. And even should they find employment, what a poor lookout is theirs! Crippled as they are by division of labour, these poor devils are worth so little outside their old trade that they cannot find admission into any industries except a few of inferior kind that are oversupplied with underpaid workmen. Footnote. A disciple of Ricardo, in answer to the insipidities of J.B. Say, remarks on this point, "Where division of labour is well developed, the skill of the labourer is available only in that particular branch in which it has been acquired. He himself is a sort of machine. It does not therefore help matters one jot to repeat in parrot fashion that things have a tendency to find their level. On looking around us, we cannot but see that they are unable to find their level for a long time, and that when they do find it, the level is always lower than at the commencement of the process." An Inquiry into Those Principles Respecting the Nature of Demand, etc., 1821. End of footnote. Further, every branch of industry attracts each year a new stream of men, who furnish a contingent from which to fill up vacancies and to draw a supply for expansion. So soon as machinery sets free a part of the workmen employed in a given branch of industry, the reserve men are also diverted into new channels of employment and become absorbed in other branches. Meanwhile, the original victims, during the period of transition, for the most part starve and perish. It is an undoubted fact that machinery as such is not responsible for setting free the workman from the means of subsistence. It cheapens and increases production in that branch which it seizes on, and at first makes no change in the mass of the means of subsistence produced in other branches. Hence, after its introduction, the society possesses as much, if not more, of the necessaries of life than before for the labourers thrown out of work, and that quite apart from the enormous share of the annual produce wasted by the non-workers. And this is the point relied on by our apologists. The contradictions and antagonisms inseparable from the capitalist employment of machinery do not exist, they say, since they do not arise out of machinery as such, but out of its capitalist employment. Since, therefore, machinery, considered alone, shortens the hours of labour, but when in the service of capital lengthens them, since in itself it lightens labour, but when employed by capital heightens the intensity of labour, since in itself it is a victory of man over the forces of nature, but in the hands of capital makes man the slave of those forces, since in itself it increases the wealth of the producers, but in the hands of capital makes them paupers, for all these reasons, and others besides, says the bourgeois economist without more ado, it is clear as noonday that all these contradictions are a mere semblance of the reality, and that, as a matter of fact, they have neither an actual nor a theoretical existence. Thus he saves himself from all further puzzling of the brain, and what is more, implicitly declares his opponent to be stupid enough to contend against not the capitalistic employment of machinery, but machinery itself. No doubt he is far from denying that temporary inconvenience may result from the capitalist use of machinery. But where is the medal without its reverse? Any employment of machinery, except by capital, is to him an impossibility. Exploitation of the workman by the machine is therefore, with him, identical with exploitation of the machine by the workman. Whoever, therefore, exposes the real state of things in the capitalistic employment of machinery is against its employment in any way, and is an enemy of social progress. Footnote. McCulloch, amongst others, is a past master in this pretentious cretinism. If, he says, with the affected naivety of a child of 8 years, if it be advantageous to develop the skill of the workman more and more so that he is capable of producing, with the same or with a less quantity of labour, a constantly increasing quantity of commodities, it must also be advantageous that he should avail himself of the help of such machinery as will assist him most effectively in the attainment of this result. McCulloch, Principles of Political Economy, 1830. End of footnote. Exactly the reasoning of the celebrated Bill Sykes. Gentlemen of the jury, no doubt the throat of this commercial traveller has been cut. But that is not my fault, it is the fault of the knife. Must we, for such temporary inconvenience, abolish the use of the knife? Only consider, where would agriculture and trade be without the knife? Is it not as salutary in surgery as it is knowing in anatomy, and in addition a willing help at the festive board? If you abolish the knife, you hurl us back into the depths of barbarism. Footnote. The inventor of the spinning machine has ruined India, a fact, however, that touches us but little. A tiers de la propriété. Monsieur Thiers here confounds the spinning machine with the power loom. A fact, however, that touches us but little. End of footnote. Although machinery necessarily throws men out of work in those industries into which it is introduced, yet it may, notwithstanding this, bring about an increase of employment in other industries. This effect, however, has nothing in common with the so-called theory of compensation. Since every article produced by a machine is cheaper than a similar article produced by hand, we deduced the following infallible law. If the total quantity of the article produced by machinery be equal to the total quantity of the article previously produced by a handicraft or by manufacture and now made by machinery, then the total labour expended is diminished. The new labour spent on the instruments of labour, on the machinery, on the coal, and so on, must necessarily be less than the labour displaced by the use of the machinery. Otherwise, the product of the machine would be as dear or dearer than the product of the manual labour. But as a matter of fact, the total quantity of the article produced by machinery with a diminished number of workmen, instead of remaining equal to, by far exceeds the total quantity of the handmade article that has been displaced. Suppose that 400,000 yards of cloth have been produced on power looms by fewer weavers than could weave 100,000 yards by hand. In the quadrupled product, there lies four times as much raw material. Hence, the production of raw material must be quadrupled. But as regards the instruments of labour, such as buildings, coal, machinery, and so on, it is different. The limit up to which the additional labour required for their production can increase varies with the difference between the quantity of the machine-made article and the quantity of the same article that the same number of workmen could make by hand. Hence, as the use of machinery extends in a given industry, the immediate effect is to increase production in the other industries that furnish the first with means of production. How far employment is thereby found for an increased number of men depends, given the length of the working day and the intensity of labour, on the composition of the capital employed, that is, on the ratio of its constant to its variable component. This ratio, in its turn, varies considerably with the extent to which machinery has already seized on, or is then seizing on, those trades. The number of the men condemned to work in coal and metal mines increased enormously owing to the progress of the English factory system, but during the last few decades this increase of number has been less rapid owing to the use of new machinery in mining. Footnote. According to the census of 1861, the number of people employed in coal mines in England and Wales amounted to 246,613, of which 73,545 were under and 173,067 were over 20 years. Of those under 20, 20,835 were between 5 and 10 years, 30,701 between 10 and 15 years, 42,010 between 15 and 19 years. The number employed in iron, copper, lead, tin, and other mines of every description was 319,222. End of footnote. A new type of workman springs into life along with the machine, namely, its maker. We have already learnt that machinery has possessed itself even of this branch of production on a scale that grows greater every day. Footnote. In England and Wales, in 1861, there were employed in making machinery 60,807 persons, including the masters and their clerks, etc., also all agents and business people connected with this industry, but excluding the makers of small machines, such as sewing machines, etc., as also the makers of the operative parts of machines, such as spindles. The total number of civil engineers amounted to 3,329. End of footnote. As to raw material, since iron is one of the most important raw materials, let me here state that in 1861 there were in England and Wales 125,771 operative iron founders, of whom 123,430 were males, 2,341 females. Of the former, 30,810 were under and 92,620 over 20 years. End of footnote. As to raw material, there is not the least doubt that the rapid strides of cotton spinning not only pushed on with tropical luxuriance the growth of cotton in the United States, and with it the African slave trade, but also made the breeding of slaves the chief business of the border slave states. When, in 1790, the first census of slaves was taken in the United States, their number was 697,000. In 1861, it had nearly reached 4 millions. On the other hand, it is no less certain that the rise of the English woolen factories, together with the gradual conversion of arable land into sheep pasture, brought about the superfluity of agricultural labourers that led to their being driven in masses into the towns. Ireland, having during the last 20 years reduced its population by nearly one half, is at this moment undergoing the process of still further reducing the number of its inhabitants, so as exactly to suit the requirements of its landlords and of the English woolen manufacturers. When machinery is applied to any of the preliminary or intermediate stages through which the subject of labour has to pass on its way to completion, there is an increased yield of material in those stages, and simultaneously an increased demand for labour in the handicrafts or manufactures supplied by the produce of the machines. Spinning by machinery, for example, supplied yarn so cheaply and so abundantly that the hand loom weavers were at first able to work full-time without increased outlay. Their earnings accordingly rose. Footnote. A family of four grown-up persons, with two children as winders, earned at the end of the last and the beginning of the present century, by 10 hours daily labour, £4 a week. If the work was very pressing, they could earn more. Before that, they had always suffered from a deficient supply of yarn. Gaskell, end of footnote. Hence a flow of people into the cotton weaving trade, till at length the 800,000 weavers, called into existence by the jenny, the throstle, and the mule, were overwhelmed by the power loom. So, owing to the abundance of clothing materials produced by machinery, the number of tailors, seamstresses, and needlewomen went on increasing until the appearance of the sewing machine. In proportion as machinery, with the aid of a relatively small number of workpeople, increases the mass of raw materials, intermediate products, instruments of labour, etc., the working up of these raw materials and intermediate products becomes split up into numberless branches. Social production increases in diversity. The factory system carries the social division of labour immeasurably further than does manufacture, for it increases the productiveness of the industries it seizes upon in a far higher degree. The immediate result of machinery is to augment surplus value and the mass of products in which surplus value is embodied. And, as the substances consumed by the capitalists and their dependents become more plentiful, so too do these orders of society. Their growing wealth and the relatively diminished number of workmen required to produce the necessaries of life beget simultaneously with the rise of new and luxurious wants the means of satisfying those wants. A larger proportion of the produce of society is changed into surplus produce, and a larger part of the surplus produce is supplied for consumption in a multiplicity of refined shapes. In other words, the production of luxuries increases. Footnote. Friedrich Engels in Lager, etc., points out the miserable condition of a large number of those who work on these very articles of luxury. See also numerous instances in the Reports of the Children's Employment Commission. End of footnote. The refined and varied forms of the products are also due to new relations with the markets of the world, relations that are created by modern industry. Not only are greater quantities of foreign articles of luxury exchanged for home products, but a greater mass of foreign raw materials, ingredients, and intermediate products are used as means of production in the home industries. Owing to these relations with the markets of the world, the demand for labour increases in the carrying trades, which split up into numerous varieties. Footnote: In 1861, in England and Wales, there were 94,665 sailors in the merchant service. End of footnote. The increase of the means of production and subsistence, accompanied by a relative diminution in the number of labourers, causes an increased demand for labour in making canals, docks, tunnels, bridges, and so on, works that can only bear fruit in the far future. Entirely new branches of production, creating new fields of labour, are also formed as the direct result either of machinery or of the general industrial changes brought about by it. But the place occupied by these branches in the general production is, even in the most developed countries, far from important. The number of labourers that find employment in them is directly proportional to the demand created by those industries for the crudest form of manual labour. The chief industries of this kind are, at present, gasworks, telegraphs, photography, steam navigation, and railways. According to the census of 1861 for England and Wales, we find in the gas industry, gasworks, production of mechanical apparatus, servants of the gas companies, etc., 15,211 persons. In telegraphy, 2,399. In photography, 2,366. Steam navigation, 3,570. And in railways, 70,599, of whom the unskilled navvies, more or less permanently employed, and the whole administrative and commercial staff, make up about 28,000. The total number of persons, therefore, employed in these five new industries amounts to 94,145. Lastly, the extraordinary productiveness of modern industry, accompanied as it is by both a more extensive and a more intense exploitation of labour power in all other spheres of production, allows of the unproductive employment of a larger and larger part of the working class, and the consequent reproduction, on a constantly extending scale, of the ancient domestic slaves under the name of a servant class, including men-servants, women-servants, lackeys, etc. According to the census of 1861, the population of England and Wales was 20,066,244. Of these, 9,776,259 males and 10,289,965 females. If we deduct from this population all who are too old or too young for work, all unproductive women, young persons and children, the ideological classes such as government, officials, priests, lawyers, soldiers, etc., further, all who have no occupation but to consume the labour of others in the form of rent, interest, etc., and lastly, paupers, vagabonds and criminals, there remain in round numbers 8 millions of the two sexes of every age, including in that number every capitalist who is in any way engaged in industry, commerce, or finance. Among these 8 millions are agricultural labourers, including shepherds, farm servants, and maidservants living in the houses of farmers, 1,098,261. All who are employed in cotton, woollen, worsted, flax, hemp, silk and jute factories, in stocking making and lace making by machinery, 642,607. Footnote: Of these, only 177,596 are males above 13 years of age. End of footnote. all who are employed in coal mines and metal mines, 565,835. All who are employed in metalworks, blast furnaces, rolling mills, etc., and metal manufacturers of every kind, 396,998. Footnote. Of these, 30,501 are females. End of footnote. The servant class, 1,208,648. Footnote. Of these, 137,447 males. None are included in the 1,208,648 who do not serve in private houses. Between 1861 and 1870, the number of male servants nearly doubled itself. It increased to 267,671. In the year 1847, there were 2,694 gamekeepers for the landlord's preserves. In 1869, there were 4,921. The young servant girls in the houses of the London lower middle class are in common parlance called slaveys. End of footnote. All the persons employed in textile factories and in mines, taken together, number 1,208,442. Those employed in textile factories and metal industries, taken together, number 1,039,605. In both cases, less than the number of modern domestic slaves. What a splendid result of the capitalist exploitation of machinery! Section 7. Repulsion and attraction of workpeople by the factory system. Crises in the cotton trade. All political economists of any standing admit that the introduction of new machinery has a baneful effect on the workmen in the old handicrafts and manufactures with which this machinery at first competes. Almost all of them bemoan the slavery of the factory operative. And what is the great trump card that they play? That machinery, after the horrors of the period of introduction and development have subsided, instead of diminishing, in the long run, increases the number of the slaves of labour. Yes, political economy revels in the hideous theory, hideous to every philanthropist who believes in the eternal, nature-ordained necessity for capitalist production, that after a period of growth and transition, even its crowning success, the factory system based on machinery grinds down more workpeople than on its first introduction it throws on the streets. Footnote. Ganil, on the contrary, considers the final result of the factory system to be an absolutely less number of operatives, at whose expense an increased number of gens honnêtes live and develop their well-known perfectibilité perfectible. Little as he understands the movement of production, at least he feels that machinery must needs be a very fatal institution if its introduction converts busy workmen into paupers and its development calls more slaves of labour into existence than it has suppressed. It is not possible to bring out the cretinism of his standpoint, except by his own words. The classes condemned to produce and to consume diminish, and the classes which direct labour, which relieve, console, and enlighten the whole population, multiply, and appropriate all the benefits which result from the diminution of the costs of labour, from the abundance of products and the cheapness of consumer goods. In this way, the human species rises to the highest creations of genius, penetrates the mysterious depths of religion, and establishes the salutary principles of morality, the laws for the protection of liberty, and power of obedience and justice, of obligation and humanity. For this twaddle, see Des Systèmes d'économie politique, etc., Charles Ganil. End of footnote. It is true that in some cases, as we saw from instances of English worsted and silk factories, an extraordinary extension of the factory system may, at a certain stage of its development, be accompanied not only by a relative, but by an absolute decrease in the number of operatives employed. In the year 1860, when a special census of all the factories in the United Kingdom was taken by order of Parliament, the factories in those parts of Lancashire, Cheshire and Yorkshire, included in the district of Mr. Baker, the factory inspector, numbered 652. 570 of these contained 85,622 power looms, 6,819,146 spindles, exclusive of doubling spindles, employed 27,439 horsepower, steam, and 1,390 water, and 94,119 persons. In the year 1865, the same factories contained looms 95,163, spindles 7,025,031, had a steam power of 28,925 horses, and a water power of 1,445 horses, and employed 88,913 persons. Between 1860 and 1865, therefore, the increase in looms was 11%, in spindles 3%, and in engine power 3%, while the number of persons employed decreased 5.5%. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. At the same time, however, means of employment for an increased number of hands was ready in 110 new mills, with 11,625 looms, 628,576 spindles, and 2,695 total horsepower of steam and water. End of footnote. Between 1852 and 1862, considerable extension of the English woolen manufacture took place, while the number of hands employed in it remained almost stationary. Showing how greatly the introduction of new machines had superseded the labour of preceding periods. Footnote. At the end of 1871, Mr. A. Redgrave, the factory inspector, in a lecture given at Bradford in the New Mechanics Institution, said, "What has struck me for some time past is the altered appearance of the woolen factories. Formerly they were filled with women and children. Now machinery seems to do all the work." At my asking for an explanation of this from a manufacturer, he gave me the following. "Under the old system I employed 63 persons. After the introduction of improved machinery, I reduced my hands to 33, and lately, in consequence of new and extensive alterations, I have been in a position to reduce those 33 to 13. End of footnote. In certain cases, the increase in the number of hands employed is only apparent. That is, it is not due to the extension of the factories already established, but to the gradual annexation of connected trades. For instance, the increase in power looms and in the hands employed by them between 1838 and 1856 was, in the cotton trade, simply owing to the extension of this branch of industry, but in the other trades to the application of steam power to the carpet loom, to the ribbon loom, and to the linen loom, which previously had been worked by the power of men. Hence the increase of the hands in these latter trades was merely a symptom of a diminution in the total number employed. Finally, we have considered this question entirely apart from the fact that everywhere except in the metal industries, young persons under 18 and women and children form the preponderating element in the class of factory hands. Nevertheless, in spite of the mass of hands actually displaced and virtually replaced by machinery, we can understand how the factory operatives, through the building of more mills and the extension of old ones in a given industry, may become more numerous than the manufacturing workmen and handicraftsmen that have been displaced. Suppose, for example, that in the old mode of production a capital of £500 is employed weekly, two-fifths being constant and three-fifths variable capital, that is, £200 being laid out in means of production, and £300, say £1 per man, in labour power. On the introduction of machinery, the composition of this capital becomes altered. We will suppose it to consist of four-fifths constant and one-fifth variable, which means that only £100 is now laid out in labour power. Consequently, two-thirds of the workmen are discharged. If now the business extends, and the total capital employed grows to £1,500 under unchanged conditions, the number of operatives employed will increase to 300, just as many as before the introduction of the machinery. If the capital further grows to £2,000, 400 men will be employed, or one-third more than under the old system. Their numbers have, in point of fact, increased by 100, but relatively, that is, in proportion to the total capital advanced, they have diminished by 800, for the £2,000 capital would, in the old state of things, have employed 1,200 instead of 400 men. Hence, a relative decrease in the number of hands is consistent with an actual increase. We have assumed that while the total capital increases, its composition remains the same, because the conditions of production remain constant. But we have already seen that with every advance in the use of machinery, the constant component of capital, that part which consists of machinery, raw material, etc., increases, while the variable component, the part laid out in labour power, decreases. We also know that in no other system of production is improvement so continuous, and the composition of the capital employed so constantly changing as in the factory system. These changes are, however, continually interrupted by periods of rest, during which there is a mere quantitative extension of the factories on the existing technical basis. During such periods, the operatives increase in number. Thus, in 1835, the total number of operatives in the cotton, woolen, worsted, flax and silk factories of the United Kingdom was only 354,684, while in 1861 the number of the power loom weavers alone, of both sexes and of all ages, from 8 years upwards, amounted to 230,654. Certainly, this growth appears less important when we consider that in 1838, the hand loom weavers with their families still numbered 800,000, not to mention those thrown out of work in Asia and on the continent of Europe. Footnote: the sufferings of the hand loom weavers were the subject of an inquiry by a royal commission, but although their distress was acknowledged and lamented, the amelioration of their condition was left, and probably necessarily so, to the chances and changes of time, which it may now be hoped, 20 years later, have nearly obliterated those miseries, and not improbably by the present great extension of the power loom. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1856. End of footnote. In the few remarks I have still to make on this point, I shall refer to some actually existing relations, the existence of which our theoretical investigation has not yet disclosed. So long as, in a given branch of industry, the factory system extends itself at the expense of the old handicrafts, or of manufacture, the result is as sure as is the result of an encounter between an army furnished with breech-loaders and one armed with bows and arrows. This first period, during which machinery conquers its field of action, is of decisive importance, owing to the extraordinary profits that it helps to produce. These profits not only form a source of accelerated accumulation, but also attract into the favoured sphere of production a large part of the additional social capital that is being constantly created, and is ever on the lookout for new investments. The special advantages of this period of fast and furious activity are felt in every branch of production that machinery invades. So soon, however, as the factory system has gained a certain breadth of footing and a definite degree of maturity, and especially so soon as its technical basis, machinery, is itself produced by machinery, so soon as coal mining and iron mining, the metal industries, and the means of transport have been revolutionized, so soon, in short, as the general conditions requisite for production by the modern industrial system have been established, this mode of production acquires an elasticity, a capacity for sudden extension by leaps and bounds, that finds no hindrance except in the supply of raw material and in the disposal of the produce. On the one hand, the immediate effect of machinery is to increase the supply of raw material in the same way, for example, as the cotton gin augmented the production of cotton. Footnote. Other ways in which machinery affects the production of raw material will be mentioned in the third book. End of footnote. On the other hand, the cheapness of the articles produced by machinery and the improved means of transport and communication furnish the weapons for conquering foreign markets. By ruining handicraft production in other countries, machinery forcibly converts them into fields for the supply of its raw material. In this way, East India was compelled to produce cotton, wool, hemp, jute, and indigo for Great Britain. By constantly making a part of the hands supernumerary, modern industry, in all countries where it has taken root, gives a spur to emigration and to the colonization of foreign lands, which are thereby converted into settlements for growing the raw material of the mother country, just as Australia, for example, was converted into a colony for growing wool. A new and international division of labour, a division suited to the requirements of the chief centres of modern industry, springs up, and converts one part of the globe into a chiefly agricultural field of production for supplying the other part, which remains a chiefly industrial field. This revolution hangs together with radical changes in agriculture, which we need not here further inquire into. Footnote. The economic development of the United States is itself a product of European, more especially of English, modern industry. In their present form, 1866, the States must still be considered a European colony. Added in the fourth German edition, since then they have developed into a country whose industry holds second place in the world, without on that account entirely losing their colonial character. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. On the motion of Mr. Gladstone, the House of Commons ordered, on the 17th of February, 1867, a return of the quinquennial total quantities of grain, corn, and flour of all sorts, imported into and exported from the United Kingdom, between the years 1831 and 1866. This showed that the excess of import over export in the years 1831 to 1835 of 871,110 quarters had risen by the years 1861 to 1866 to 14,707,117 and rising. The enormous power inherent in the factory system of expanding by jumps and the dependence of that system on the markets of the world necessarily beget feverish production followed by overfilling of the markets, whereupon contraction of the markets brings on crippling of production. The life of modern industry becomes a series of periods of moderate activity, prosperity, overproduction, crisis, and stagnation. The uncertainty and instability to which machinery subjects the employment and consequently the conditions of existence of the operatives become normal, owing to these periodic changes of the industrial cycle. Except in the periods of prosperity, there rages between the capitalists the most furious combat for the share of each in the markets. This share is directly proportional to the cheapness of the product. Besides the rivalry that this struggle begets in the application of improved machinery for replacing labour power and of new methods of production, there also comes a time in every industrial cycle when a forcible reduction of wages beneath the value of labour power is attempted for the purpose of cheapening commodities. Footnote. In an appeal made in July 1866 to the trade societies of England by the shoemakers of Leicester, who had been thrown on the streets by a lockout, it is stated, 20 years ago the Leicester shoe trade was revolutionised by the introduction of riveting in the place of stitching. At that time, good wages could be earned. Great competition was shown between the different firms as to which could turn out the neatest article. Shortly afterwards, however, a worse kind of competition sprang up, namely that of underselling one another in the market. The injurious consequences soon manifested themselves in reduction of wages, and so sweepingly quick was the fall in the price of labour that many firms now pay only one half of the original wages. And yet, though wages sink lower and lower, profits appear, with each alteration in the scale of wages, to increase. Even bad times are utilised by the manufacturers for making exceptional profits by excessive lowering of wages, that is, by a direct robbery of the labourer's means of subsistence. One example. It has reference to the crisis in the Coventry silk weaving. From information I have received from manufacturers as well as workmen, there seems to be no doubt that wages have been reduced to a greater extent than either the competition of the foreign producers or other circumstances have rendered necessary. The majority of weavers are working at a reduction of 30 to 40% in their wages. A piece of ribbon for making which the weaver got 6 shillings or 7 shillings 5 years back now only brings him 3 and threepence, or 3 shillings and sixpence. Other work is now priced at 2 shillings and 2 and threepence, which was formerly priced at 4 shillings and 4 shillings and threepence. The reduction in wage seems to have been carried to a greater extent than is necessary for increasing demand. Indeed, the reduction in the cost of weaving, in the case of many descriptions of ribbons, has not been accompanied by any corresponding reduction in the selling price of the manufactured article. Mr. F. D. Long's report, Children's Employment Commission, 1866, end of footnote. A necessary condition, therefore, to the growth of the number of factory hands is a proportionally much more rapid growth of the amount of capital invested in mills. This growth, however, is conditioned by the ebb and flow of the industrial cycle. It is, besides, constantly interrupted by the technical progress that at one time virtually supplies the place of new workmen, at another actually displaces old ones. This qualitative change in mechanical industry continually discharges hands from the factory or shuts its doors against the fresh stream of recruits, while the purely quantitative extension of the factories absorbs not only the men thrown out of work, but also fresh contingents. The workpeople are thus continually both repelled and attracted, hustled from pillar to post, while at the same time constant changes take place in the sex, age and skill of the levies. The lot of the factory operatives will be best depicted by taking a rapid survey of the course of the English cotton industry. From 1770 to 1815, this trade was depressed or stagnant for 5 years only. During this period of 45 years, the English manufacturers had a monopoly of machinery and of the markets of the world. From 1815 to 1821, depression. 1822 and 1823, prosperity. 1824, abolition of the laws against trades unions, great extension of factories everywhere. 1825, crisis. 1826, great misery and riots among the factory operatives. 1827, slight improvement. 1828, great increase in power looms and in exports. 1829, exports, especially to India, surpass all former years. 1830, glutted markets, great distress. 1831 to 1833, continued depression. The monopoly of the trade with India and China withdrawn from the East India Company. 1834, great increase of factories and machinery, shortness of hands. The new Poor Law furthers the migration of agricultural labourers into the factory districts. The country districts swept of children. White slave trade. 1835, great prosperity. Contemporaneous starvation of the hand loom weavers. 1836, great prosperity. 1837 and 1838, depression and crisis. 1839, revival. 1840, great depression. Riots, calling out of the military. 1841 and 1842, frightful suffering among the factory operatives. 1842, the manufacturers locked the hands out of the factories in order to enforce the repeal of the Corn Laws. The operatives stream in thousands into the towns of Lancashire and Yorkshire, are driven back by the military, and their leaders brought to trial at Lancaster. 1843, great misery. 1844, revival. 1845, great prosperity. 1846, continued improvement, at first, then reaction, repeal of the Corn Laws. 1847, crisis, general reduction of wages by 10% and more in honour of the Big Loaf. 1848, continued depression. Manchester under military protection. 1849, revival. 1850, prosperity. 1851, falling prices, low wages, frequent strikes. 1852, improvement begins, strikes continue. The manufacturers threaten to import foreign hands. 1853, increasing exports. Strike for 8 months, and great misery at Preston. 1854, prosperity, glutted markets. 1855, news of failures stream in from the United States, Canada, and the Eastern markets. 1856, great prosperity. 1857, crisis. 1858, improvement. 1859, great prosperity, increase in factories. 1860, zenith of the English cotton trade, the Indian, Australian, and other markets so glutted with goods that even in 1863 they had not absorbed the whole lot. The French Treaty of Commerce, enormous growth of factories and machinery. 1861, prosperity continues for a time. Reaction, the American Civil War, cotton famine. 1862 to 1863, complete collapse. The history of the cotton famine is too characteristic to dispense with dwelling upon it for a moment. From the indications as to the condition of the markets of the world in 1860 and 1861, we see that the cotton famine came in the nick of time for the manufacturers and was, to some extent, advantageous to them, a fact that was acknowledged in the reports of the Manchester Chamber of Commerce, proclaimed in Parliament by Palmerston and Derby, and confirmed by events. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1862. End of footnote. No doubt, among the 2,887 cotton mills in the United Kingdom in 1861, there were many of small size. According to the report of Mr. A. Redgrave, out of the 2,109 mills included in his district, 392, or 19%, employed less than 10 horsepower each. 345, or 16%, employed 10 horsepower and less than 20 horsepower, while 1,372 employed upwards of 20 horsepower. The majority of the small mills were weaving sheds, built during the period of prosperity after 1858, for the most part by speculators, of whom one supplied the yarn, another the machinery, a third the buildings, and were worked by men who had been overlookers, or by other persons of small means. These small manufacturers mostly went to the wall. The same fate would have overtaken them in the commercial crisis that was staved off only by the cotton famine. Although they formed one-third of the total number of manufacturers, yet their mills absorbed a much smaller part of the capital invested in the cotton trade. As to the extent of the stoppage, it appears from authentic estimates that in October 1862, 60.3% of the spindles and 58% of the looms were standing. This refers to the cotton trade as a whole, and of course requires considerable modification for individual districts. Only very few mills worked full-time, 60 hours a week. The remainder worked at intervals. Even in those few cases where full-time was worked, and at the customary rate of piece wage, the weekly wages of the operatives necessarily shrank, owing to good cotton being replaced by bad, Sea Island by Egyptian, in fine spinning mills, American and Egyptian by Surat, and pure cotton by mixings of waste and Surat. The shorter fibre of the Surat cotton and its dirty condition, the greater fragility of the thread, the substitution of all sorts of heavy ingredients for flour in sizing the warps, all these lessened the speed of the machinery or the number of looms that could be superintended by one weaver, increased the labour caused by defects in the machinery, and reduced the piece wage by reducing the mass of the product turned off. Where Surat cotton was used, the loss to the operatives, when on full time, amounted to 20, 30 and more percent. But besides this, the majority of the manufacturers reduced the rate of piece wage by 5, 7.5 and 10%. We can therefore conceive the situation of those hands who were employed for only 3, 3.5 or 4 days a week, or for only 6 hours a day. Even in 1863, after a comparative improvement had set in, the weekly wages of spinners and of weavers were 3 and 4 pence, 3 and 10 pence, 4 and 6 pence, and 5 shillings and a penny. Footnote. Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1863. End of footnote. Even in this miserable state of things, however, the inventive spirit of the master never stood still, but was exercised in making deductions from wages. These were, to some extent, inflicted as a penalty for defects in the finished article that were really due to his bad cotton and to his unsuitable machinery. Moreover, where the manufacturer owned the cottages of the workpeople, he paid himself his rents by deducting the amount from these miserable wages. Mr. Redgrave tells us of self-acting minders, operatives who manage a pair of self-acting mules, earning at the end of a fortnight's full work 8 shillings and 11 pence, and that from this sum was deducted the rent of the house, the manufacturer, however, returning half the rent as a gift. The minders took away the sum of 6 shillings and 11 pence. In many places, the self-acting minders ranged from 5 shillings to 9 shillings per week, and the weavers from 2 shillings to 6 shillings per week, during the latter part of 1862. Even when working short time, the rent was frequently deducted from the wages of the operatives. No wonder that in some parts of Lancashire a kind of famine fever broke out. But more characteristic than all this was the revolution that took place in the process of production at the expense of the workpeople. Experimenta in corpore vili, like those of anatomists on frogs, were formerly made. Although, says Mr. Redgrave, I have given the actual earnings of the operatives in the several mills, it does not follow that they can earn the same amount week by week. The operatives are subject to great fluctuation from the constant experimentalizing of the manufacturers. The earnings of the operatives rise and fall with the quality of the cotton mixings. Sometimes they have been within 15% of former earnings, and then, in a week or two, they have fallen off from 50% to 60%. These experiments were not made solely at the expense of the workman's means of subsistence. His five senses also had to pay the penalty. The people who are employed in making up Surat cotton complain very much. They inform me, on opening the bales of cotton, there is an intolerable smell, which causes sickness. In the mixing, scribbling, and carding rooms, the dust and dirt, which are disengaged, irritate the air passages and give rise to cough and difficulty of breathing. A disease of the skin, no doubt from the irritation of the dirt contained in the Surat cotton, also prevails. The fibre being so short, a great amount of size, both animal and vegetable, is used. Bronchitis is more prevalent owing to the dust. Inflammatory sore throat is common from the same cause. Sickness and dyspepsia are produced by the frequent breaking of the weft, when the weaver sucks the weft through the eye of the shuttle. On the other hand, the substitutes for flour were a fortunatus purse to the manufacturers, by increasing the weight of the yarn. They caused 15 pounds of raw material to weigh 26 pounds after it was woven. In the report of inspectors of factories for the 30th of April 1864, we read as follows. The trade is availing itself of this resource at present to an extent which is even discreditable. I have heard on good authority of a cloth weighing 8 pounds, which was made of 5 1/4 pounds of cotton and 2 3/4 pounds of size, and of another cloth weighing 5 1/4 pounds, of which 2 pounds was size. These were ordinary export shirtings. In cloths of other descriptions, as much as 50% size is sometimes added, so that a manufacturer may, and does truly boast, that he is getting rich by selling cloth for less money per pound than he paid for the mere yarn of which they are composed. But the workpeople had to suffer not only from the experiments of the manufacturers inside the mills and of the municipalities outside, not only from reduced wages and absence of work, from want and from charity, and from the eulogistic speeches of lords and commons. Unfortunate females who, in consequence of the cotton famine, were at its commencement thrown out of employment, and have thereby become outcasts of society, and now, though trade has revived and work is plentiful, continue members of that unfortunate class, and are likely to continue so. There are also in the borough more youthful prostitutes than I have known for the last 25 years. Footnote. From a letter of Mr. Harris, Chief Constable of Bolton, in Reports of Inspector of Factories, 31st of October, 1865. End of footnote. We find, then, in the first 45 years of the English cotton trade, from 1770 to 1815, only 5 years of crisis and stagnation. But this was the period of monopoly. The second period, from 1815 to 1863, counts, during its 48 years, only 20 years of revival and prosperity against 28 of depression and stagnation. Between 1815 and 1830, the competition with the continent of Europe and with the United States sets in. After 1833, the extension of the Asiatic markets is enforced by destruction of the human race, the wholesale extinction of Indian handloom weavers. After the repeal of the Corn Laws, from 1846 to 1863, there are 8 years of moderate activity and prosperity against 9 years of depression and stagnation. The condition of the adult male operatives, even during the years of prosperity, may be judged from the note. Subjoined. Footnote. In an appeal dated 1863, of the factory operatives of Lancashire, etc., for the purpose of forming a society for organized emigration, we find the following. That a large emigration of factory workers is now absolutely essential to raise them from their present prostrate condition, few will deny. But to show that a continuous stream of emigration is at all times demanded, and without which it is impossible for them to maintain their position in ordinary times, we beg to call attention to the subjoined facts. The official value of cotton goods exported was 17,665,378 pounds, whilst the real marketable value was 20,070,824 pounds. In 1858, the official value of cotton goods exported was 182,221,681 pounds, but the real or marketable value was only 43,001,322 pounds, being a tenfold quantity sold for little more than double the former price. To produce results so disadvantageous to the country generally, and to the factory workers in particular, several causes have cooperated, which, had circumstances permitted, we should have brought more prominently under your notice. Suffice it for the present to say that the most obvious one is the constant redundancy of labour, without which a trade so ruinous in its effects never could have been carried on, and which requires a constantly extending market to save it from annihilation. Our cotton mills may be brought to a stand by the periodical stagnations of trade, which under present arrangements are as inevitable as death itself. But the human mind is constantly at work, and although we believe we are under the mark in stating that 6 millions of persons have left these shores during the last 25 years, yet from the natural increase of population and the displacement of labour to cheapen production, a large percentage of the male adults in the most prosperous times find it impossible to obtain work in factories on any conditions whatever. Reports of the Inspector of Factories, 30th of April, 1863. We shall, in a later chapter, see how our friends the manufacturers endeavoured, during the catastrophe in the cotton trade, to prevent by every means, including state interference, the emigration of the operatives. End of footnote. Section 8. Revolution effected in manufacture, handicrafts, and domestic industry by modern industry. A. Overthrow of cooperation based on handicraft and on the division of labour. We have seen how machinery does away with cooperation based on handicrafts, and with manufacture based on the division of handicraft labour. An example of the first sort is the mowing machine. It replaces cooperation between mowers. A striking example of the second kind is the needle-making machine. According to Adam Smith, 10 men, in his day, made in cooperation over 48,000 needles a day. On the other hand, a single needle machine makes 145,000 in a working day of 11 hours. One woman or one girl superintends 4 such machines, and so produces near upon 600,000 needles in a day, and upwards of 3 million in a week. Footnote. Children's Employment Commission, 1864. End of footnote. A single machine, when it takes the place of cooperation or of manufacture, may itself serve as the basis of an industry of a handicraft character. Still, such a return to handicrafts is but a transition to the factory system, which as a rule makes its appearance, so soon as the human muscles are replaced, for the purpose of driving the machines by a mechanical motive power, such as steam or water. Here and there, but in any case only for a time, an industry may be carried on a small scale by means of mechanical power, This is effected by hiring steam power, as is done in some of the Birmingham trades, or by the use of small caloric engines, as in some branches of weaving. Footnote. In the United States, the restoration in this way of handicrafts based on machinery is frequent, and therefore, when the inevitable transition to the factory system shall take place, the ensuing concentration will, compared with Europe and even with England, stride on in seven-league boots. End of footnote. In the Coventry silk weaving industry, the experiment of cottage factories was tried. In the centre of a square surrounded by rows of cottages, an engine house was built, and the engine connected by shafts with the looms in the cottages. In all cases, the power was hired at so much per loom. The rent was payable weekly, whether the looms worked or not. Each cottage held from 2 to 6 looms. Some belonged to the weaver, some were bought on credit, some were hired. The struggle between these cottage factories